Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, 30-odd years ago, a teenaged Australian named Arna Rubinstein embraced some risky behavior. Later on, the young man who became Dr. Arna Rubinstein worked in emergency rooms, where he saw more than enough of what happens when teenagers take risks. Through an organization he founded, The Making of Men, Dr. Rubinstein is now focused on helping young people become adults in safe and healthy ways. If you are looking for ways to help your child, or a child in your life, navigate the challenges they face, his insights and reflections into healthy rites of passage are worth a long listen.
So when we run a program, if I'm running a program for fathers and sons, at the end of the program, each of the boys will come up one at a time, sit on a special chair in front of everyone, and then his father will get up in front of everyone and tell his son what he loves about him, what he's proud of, what gifts he sees that he has. And it changes his life. It absolutely changes his life. And then another man will get up, and then one of the other leaders will get up and tell this young man what they see in him. And same with the girls. The mothers, the women will get up and tell each of the girls, each of the young women, what they see in them, the beauty, the gifts, the talents, and the genius. Changes their lives. I want every kid in the world to have that opportunity to be honoured and recognised by their elders and told exactly who you are. It's perfect, beautiful, wonderful. We see you, we recognise you, we love you.
Dr. Arna Rubinstein spoke at Seattle University's Piggott Auditorium on April 19th. The event was hosted by the Vashon Island-based organization Journeyman. Founders Nikki Wilkes and Alex Craighead introduced the talk. We're presenting our abridged podcast version here. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum.
My name is Nikki Wilkes.
And my name is Alex Craighead.
And together, we've founded Journeyman, a local nonprofit engaging in youth rites of passage and mentorship programs for boys in Puget Sound. Alex and I were born in, were raised on Vashon Island. And I like to think of Vashon as a wonderful garden of a place to be a child. We have abundant elements of nature. We had parents who were willing to show up for us and who really cared about our upbringing. And we had a very supportive community. In some ways, it seemed like we had all the ingredients for success and for having a healthy childhood. As we got older, I noticed that things started to shift.
Being a teen in our small community presented its own unique challenges. With limited engaging activities, a lack of healthy role models, and few opportunities for healthy and appropriate risks, we ultimately created our own. Fighting, binge drinking until we blacked out, and driving dangerously fast, eventually resulting in Nikki and I crashing our cars. We were a threat to ourselves and our community.
But from the outside looking in, you probably wouldn't have been able to tell. We were successful in school, getting good grades. We had lots of friends, and we were successful in sports, eventually winning a state championship. We carried this momentum forward as friends and decided to leave our home together, venturing off to college to pursue our dream of playing college across. And that next stage of our journey presented even more challenges.
Moving to any new community presents a new set of challenges. Lacking our own sense of identity, we struggled to fit the mold of those around us. As lacrosse players at a private college on the East Coast, that meant undue privilege and entitlement, surrounded by misogyny and toxic masculinity. We felt lost, but we knew that we needed to leave in order to find our place in the world.
The next stage in my journey brought me to Southern California. Changing my major to business and economics, I began to see how those same wounds that we were dealing with on a personal level could play out in the larger scale. As I was approaching the completion of my master's program, I met a young woman, and we became pregnant. Facing the reality of becoming a father was both the most terrifying and the most empowering moment of my life. Though I had been showing up for young people as a mentor, the thought of having a young person looking up to me for everything was scary, to say the least. Right around this time, I recommitted myself professionally to working with youth. I started my first job as a college admission counselor, guiding that transition from high school to college. And I started showing up on the lacrosse field again as a coach, meeting the youth where I knew that they were in a way that felt appropriate for me. It was also right around this time that I began drafting the original framework for our organization, staying up late at night, writing, creating the business plan, reaching out, talking to people, and eventually I sent the email to Alex. Do you remember how you responded?
I said, let's do this.
Yeah, and I responded with, I'm not ready.
And it wasn't the time. I was teaching in Germany, having recently graduated from right here at Seattle University with my master's in teaching, and Nikki was on the other side of the world. But a seed was planted. Moving back to the United States, I actually landed the most meaningful job that I've had in my entire life. Teaching at Gateway High School in San Francisco, where 90% of our students were involved in gang activity, I came to the realization that despite our differences, we shared many of the same struggles. Traveling home that same year for the holidays, it became even more clear. A childhood friend of ours took his life. And we continued to hear stories of more and more people that were struggling to find their way in the world. In hopes of trying to bring some light to this dark time in our community, we decided to offer free hugs and hot chocolate at the main intersection in our town on New Year's Day. And we knew that that was not enough.
That next summer, sitting on a pile of logs that would later be used to build my first home, Alex and I had another conversation. Do you remember how you asked?
I said, are you ready? Because now is the time.
Yeah, and this time I was. So we shook hands, we made a commitment. And since that day, we've been doing everything in our power to bring this work to our people. Since incorporating last year, we've done everything we can to call in our support, to bring these programs to the community of Vashon, and eventually reach out to the boys in Puget Sound to create a network of mentors and to create a space for young men to discover who they really are, to find the support that they need to show up and make a graceful transition into adulthood. So without further ado, we'd like to go ahead and welcome our keynote speaker for the evening, best-selling author of The Making of Men, and our guest tonight, Dr. Arna Rubenstein.
Okay, well, g'day everybody. My name's Arna, and thank you for coming along tonight. And that's as beautiful a welcome as I've ever been given to a talk that I've been at. And Nikki and Alex, thank you, and everybody for coming along. I started in Sydney 48 hours ago. Yesterday, I was in Eugene. It was amazing. I had summer and winter and spring and fall all in a day. This morning, I got up early, flew here to Seattle, my first time in Seattle, which is great. And here we are at Seattle University. So I'm very interested in this idea of thriving teenagers. And that story is so poignant because I see that so often. And what I want teenagers, boys and girls, to be motivated about life, to have a vision, to have good friends, to be going somewhere, to be excited, all of that stuff. And when I was getting ready for this talk and getting some slides together, I found a slide of myself when I was a teenager. And I don't think much has changed, but maybe it has actually. And I remember that time. Similar sort of thing. You know, I was 17, I was at a good school, had a good family, you know, no big problems, but I had two lives. I had the life that they knew about, and I had the life that they didn't know about. And in the life that they didn't know about, I kind of struggled, and I was a bit flat, maybe even depressed. And I was looking for trouble. I was looking for whatever trouble I could find. And it's only through luck that I didn't get in way bigger trouble than I could have. And I remember when I got my license and I used to slide my car around the corners and drive as fast as I could. And if I could get alcohol, drink, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And it was a hard time. And the big thing for me, I remember, is I didn't really have anybody to talk to. And I certainly didn't have role models. And I certainly, you know, I didn't know, am I a boy or am I a man? I was supposed to act like a man, but I was being treated like a boy. And there was a lot of confusion. Anyway, at quite a young age, I became a father. And these are my two boys, Jara and Jaden, when they were 4 and 6 years old, at that beautiful age where when you squeeze them, their ribs kind of move. They got give. And I was Superman. Beautiful, beautiful. And so this is actually Jaden's 4th birthday and Jara's 6. Who's got kids in here, by the way? Great. Who's got teenagers? All right. Anybody got kids under 10? Great. A lot of people with young kids. Anybody got kids under 2? Anybody pregnant? Hey, fellas at the front. I love that. Thank you very much. So I also had a career as a doctor, and I had a family practice for a while, but I worked in emergency medicine mainly. And I spent 25 years working as an emergency medicine doctor, initially full-time, and then for about the last 10 years, very part-time. And I finally stopped about a year ago. And this is quite an interesting photo because lying on the stretcher is a 15-year-old boy. And he thought it would be fun with his mates to steal his dad's car and go for a drive. Actually, ever since I've had this slide, I ask this question to all the audiences. Put up your hand if when you were a teenager, you stole your mum or your dad's car and went out for a joyride. Wow, that's impressive. Stand up so we can actually see who you are. Stand up. Great, I love it. Well-dressed, respectable-looking, all stole your dad's cars or mum's cars and went for a drive. Okay, so this kid, he thought it'd be fun to do that. That bit worked okay. And then he said to one of his mates, you drive, I'm going to surf on the roof. Now he's in hospital with a badly broken leg, in emergency. But I would actually consider him to be one of the lucky ones because he made it to the hospital. And he will eventually go home from the hospital. And in my 25 years working in emergency, I know they're not all that lucky. The reason why I have stopped working as a doctor in the medical system is because I now work full-time with boys and men. And I do a lot of one-on-one mentoring. This is young Will, who I've known since he was about 6 years old. He's now 13. And one of the things I've discovered is a great way to keep teenage boys happy is to give them a knife. And the bigger the knife, the better. And this is Jed, who I've known since he was a young boy as well. And the other great thing for boys is to give them lots of food. I also run programs. We run camps, and we ran our first camp for boys and men in 1994. And since then, I've been involved in setting up and creating camps, and we have camps that run all over Australia, and we've also run our camps in about 10 countries around the world, and we've had over 30,000 people involved in what we're doing. So I'm really excited to be here in Seattle, and really excited that this weekend at Vashon, on Friday, we're going to run a Global Rites of Passage Leadership Training Day. And on the weekend, we're going to run a camp for boys and their fathers. Well, and actually, we're going to have a grandfather along as well, which is great. We love grandfathers. By the way, there's a saying that grandparents and grandchildren have a special bond because they have a common enemy. Anyway, it's just a saying. I also have been involved a lot in helping to set up programs for girls And I'm equally as passionate about the work happening for girls. I don't do it personally. I work with boys and men, but I really want to see this work happening for girls. And I also need to say, really early on, I have not been the perfect father. I'm a million miles off being the perfect man. Do we have any perfect fathers or mothers or men or women in the room, by the way? Maybe. Okay, because I'm looking for someone. I haven't found anyone yet. But for me, you know, it's not actually about being perfect. It's about the journey. And my hope is that as a result of tonight, we can all take away at least one thing that we can do with our children, our partners, our friends, something, our community, that we all take away at least one thing. So that's what I'm aiming for. Okay, but I'm mainly going to talk about children because the topic tonight is parenting technology and modern rites of passage. And I reckon that when our children are born, they're like little astronauts. And our role is to build them a rocket so that one day they can take off on their own journey and we try and build them the best rocket we can. And the idea is that when they do take off, hopefully they've got some idea how to steer the rocket. They've got maybe some idea where they're going. They keep some amount of communication going with ground control. And they're away. And I'd like to ask a question. So I'm very interested. Most of my work is in Australia, and I'm always interested when I go to another country to see what's similar and what's different in the places we go. So for those of us who have children, and if you imagine your children at, say, 25 years of age, what would we consider, you know, success as a parent? What would we want? If we could use one or two words to describe our children at, say, 20, 25 years of age, how would we like them to be? Anybody, put your hand up. Yeah.
Financially independent.
Financially independent. Okay. Does that mean not living with you?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Christian.
Happy.
Happy. Fabulous. Who else? Joyful. Beautiful. Sir.
Like,
ma'am, sorry.
Like Nikki.
Like Nikki. Right. Okay.
Passionate,
yeah.
Self-aware.
Discerning. Great. Anyone else? Yeah.
Enjoy love and work.
Enjoy love and work. All right. So, you know, very similar to what we hear in Australia. And nothing that you've said sounds impossible. And I think we should be able to, I think, you know, at a minimum, we should be hoping that our children can do that. We also know that rockets don't always do so well, and sometimes they explode. And I remember when my children were young, and they're in their 20s now, I remember thinking, you know, what are my kids going to be like when they're teenagers? Am I going to have kids who are doing really well? Am I going to have kids who still want to talk to me, want to spend time with me, who've got good friends? Or are my kids going to be a disaster? Am I going to have kids who are on drugs? Am I going to have kids who've got mental health issues? Am I going to have kids who I don't even know where they are? Anything. And is it just a matter of luck? Do I have to just hope they turn out okay? Or are there things I can be doing about it? And without any doubt, I believe it's not just a matter of luck. There's an enormous amount we can do. And that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. But I also, tonight, where I am, it's actually Thursday lunchtime. Or where I usually am. And here, what are we? We're Wednesday evening. Okay. So, Seattle, 2017. Bunch of parents. What do we worry about when your children are teenagers, when they're in their 20s? What is it that we worry about here in Seattle? Anybody?
Safety.
Safety. Any particular sort of safety? Just safety.
Physical.
Yeah. Great. Well, not great. Yes. Who else? Yeah.
Media.
The media. As in the influence of the media?
Yeah, just like too much screen time.
Ah. Okay, too many movies, too much screen time. They get lost in the whole technology thing. Yeah, huge. Okay, who else? Yeah. Addictions. Yeah. And by the way, as far as drugs and addictions go, what I say is, it's not a matter of keeping our kids away from drugs and addictions. That shouldn't be our aim because we actually can't do it. Drugs are everywhere. What we really need to be thinking about is when drugs get offered to our children, why are some going to say yes and some going to say no? Because they will get offered. But it's about what they choose to do and how can we influence that. All right, anybody else? Yeah.
Lack of joy.
Lack of joy. Yeah. Okay. And last one?
Lack of community.
Lack of community. All things that we hear in Australia. In Australia, we also have a big issue with car accidents. We put a cross up on the road when someone gets killed. And in the last 3 years, there have been 5 crosses put up in the road on the road near the town where I live, all under 25, all alcohol or drug related, all unnecessary. That's a big issue in Australia. Mental health is a huge issue in Australia. As teenagers, approximately 1 in 3 children are considered in any year to have a mental health issue. How can that be? I find that's completely staggering. So I'm very interested in, you know, why is it that children act out, children of any age? And maybe the best way I can illustrate it is a story of when I was working as a doctor and a mother brought her 5-year-old son to see me, and I'd known the kid since he was a baby. And she said, "Dr. Rubenstein, I need you to look at my son. Something's going on. He's started having temper tantrums and he's wetting his bed at night. And he stopped doing that nearly 2 years ago. You know, maybe he's got a urinary tract infection." So I said, "Okay, we'll have a look at..." We had a look at him. Didn't have a temperature. His tummy was nice and soft. Looked at his urine. That was all okay. Couldn't find anything. And I said to Mum, "Okay, has anything else gone on?" And this is like nearly 20 years ago. And she said, "Well, actually, just before all of this started, at school, they had a father and son or father and child day where the dads or grandfathers or someone came along with the kids and they spent the morning at their preschool. And I'm a single mother and there's no father and no grandfather in the area, so my son went to school and he didn't have anyone with him." And I think, oh no, you know, I get emotional when I think about this. Imagine, you know, a 5-year-old boy at school, watching all the other boys with their dads or someone, and he's there on his own. And he can't come home and say, "Look, you know, I'm a bit emotionally distressed and I've got some issues," you know, doesn't happen. What's he do? He comes home and he starts having temper tantrums and wetting the bed. And for anyone who's a parent, you know, we know when our children are acting up, what else is going on? Are they overtired? Are they unwell? And you can see it so easily in young children, but it's no different in teenagers. You know, I've worked with teenagers who've done really bad things. They've been in jail, or remand, we call it in Australia. They've been violent. They've stolen things. They've abused. Bad stuff. And you think, oh, this is a bad teenager. And then I ask them, you know, "So what's it like at home?" They go, "Home? These are kids who've been abused. These are kids who've been kicked out. These are kids whose parents are alcoholic. These are kids who've been beaten." And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, the behaviour. The behaviour's not okay, but maybe I understand more where it's coming from. And I believe it's not only with kids and teenagers, it's with adults. And for me, I'm very much of the belief that when the environment is not appropriate, when the environment's not is not working, that's when bad behaviours come out. They did some research in Australia some years ago where they asked a few thousand people between the ages of 12 and 70 how they felt about life, how they felt about their jobs, how they felt about the future, how safe they felt, what their friendship group was like. It's called subjective well-being. Actually, it's happiness. And this is the result that came out. So this is 12 years of age. This is 16 years of age, 55 years of age. And interestingly, it goes back up at about 70. So if you live to 70 in Australia, you'll be really happy like you were at 12 for some reason. And that really interests me, but the bit that really, really interests me and concerns me is this, the big drop that happens. And so this is in Australia, but you know, I've worked in a lot of different countries, and consistently I hear it's very similar. And I think about, so why would a 12-year-old in Australia be so happy? Well, in Australia, most 12-year-olds go to pretty good schools. They get three meals a day. They come home. There's some food there for them. They don't have much homework. They play. Someone cooks them dinner. After dinner, they take off their clothes and drop them on the floor and get in a bath that someone's made for them. They get out of the bath. Someone dries their tummy, turn around, dries their back, gives them a kiss. They go to bed. Someone reads them a story, gives them another kiss, turns out the light. You know, they have a taxi service. They have a restaurant. It's great. Life as a 12-year-old in Australia is great. And yet, by 16, they're really struggling. And given that there are, in fact, kids who are also doing well, the ones who are struggling are really struggling. And that worries me. And that's the part that I'm interested in addressing. And one of the big things we need to know is that the Gen Zs today, life is significantly different than what it was like when I was growing up or some other people here were growing up. And the biggest difference is technology, the influence of technology. The average age of smartphone ownership in Australia is about 12 and a half. And each year, that age goes down by 2 years. So a year ago, it was 14 and a half. Now it's 12 and a half. Within a year, it'll be 10 and a half. And pretty soon, every kid, 7, 8, 9 years of age, will have a phone just in case. I mean, when I was a kid, I'm sounding my age now, we came home, we got on our bikes, and we were gone. And the rule was, you have to be home by dark or dinner. And you have to bring your sister home. That was it. And if something happened, if we fell off our bike and hurt ourselves, we still had to get home. And if our bike had a flat tire, we still had to get home. And if we got lost, we had to ride around until we found our way home. And that's what you did. We didn't have the mobile phones everywhere. And in Australia, the research is showing that teenagers are spending anywhere between 3 and 11 hours per day looking at screens. Who grew up and didn't even have screens or just had television? Yeah. In Australia, in a lot of the schools, every child has to have an iPad or a laptop. Is that whose children at school have to have an iPad or a laptop? Is it very common or it's not so common here? There was a big fuss in Australia recently because one of the schools introduced this thing that they had to actually have an iPad from kindergarten. And this is about 2 years ago. Now it doesn't even make the papers because most schools. And yes, that's to do their homework and a creative way of learning, but then afterwards, they still have the iPad. So it's a huge issue in Australia. And there's also research coming out that the neural pathway, so the neural pathway are the learning pathways in your brain, and they get formed according to which bit gets used the most. So if I use that particular neural pathway a lot, it will form as a lifelong neural pathway. And there's already research coming out that the neural pathways are being affected by the use of technology. The impact of that is unknown because it's a relatively new thing, but they know that it's affecting it. And the other thing is, I'm very interested in something called global megatrends. And that means when there's a lot of research around what's going to happen in 5, 10, 15 years' time. It's not a complete mystery. They already know. And they know that things like ambient computing is going to become a lot more influential. Platforms, which we already see having an influence in things like Uber and Airbnb and car sharing, all of that sort of stuff. The smart machines, predictive analytics, all the stuff where, you know, you might go on one of the online sales platforms and I might go and look for a slingshot or a new pair of boots or a pocket knife. And then I go on Facebook and, oh, look, there's an ad for a slingshot or a new pair of boots or a pocket knife. How did that happen? Yeah, it's absolutely happening. But that's going to happen more and more and more the Internet of Things. You know, the influence is not going to become less. It's going to become way more. You know, by 2025, algorithms will be making transactions on our behalf, metacoins, blockchains, all of these things are happening more and more. Artificial intelligence is becoming huge and just starting. So we have just the beginning of it. Things like Siri on our phones and Cortana, these are just the very, very beginning of the influence of artificial intelligence. And this graph here shows the investment in artificial intelligence in America up till 2015. So this is already 2 years old. And the graph now would be way up here somewhere. So it's going to have more and more influence. Who owns a pair of virtual reality goggles, by the way? Anyone in the room? One early adopter here? There's a good chance that within 18 months, 95% of us will own virtual reality goggles. And you may shake your heads, but it's going to happen. So all the online sale, all the online things that you buy, you'll use virtual reality goggles. So if I want to buy a shirt, I'll have made an avatar with my exact size and shape. I'll put on my goggles. That will go into a shop, and I can try the shirt on and see how it fits and all of that. Or if I want to get an Airbnb in Portugal, I'll put on my goggles, I'll find the Airbnb, I can go into the apartment, I can walk around the apartment, I can look at it, I can look out the windows, I can go downstairs, I can walk up the street, see what cafes and restaurants are there, see where the bus station is. You know, all of this stuff is going to happen more and more and more. I'll just go back one slide. And one of the ways we know it's going to happen more is because of the fact that Amazon, Google, Buy, all these huge companies are investing enormous amounts of money in this. Things like driverless cars. There's a good chance that any child 10 years or younger will not actually learn how to drive because they'll be in driverless cars. This is an interesting photograph. I'm here with a man called Patrick Vincent, and this photo was taken in Sweden a year ago. And Patrick asked me to come over and give some talks, and I ran a father and son camp over there. And Patrick runs detox clinics. He runs digital detox clinics for teenagers who are addicted to video gaming and porn. So it's not an alcohol detox. It's not a drug detox. It's a digital detox clinic. And already, you know, this will be happening here in America. It's happening in Europe, starting to happen in Australia. I'm actually setting up a program on the property that I run for teenagers and men and women in their early 20s. And the first thing we'll do is separate them from their technology. So that's a huge thing. And I'm very interested, you know, it's one thing to talk about the issues and we need to know what's going on in their world, but what does it actually take for teenagers to thrive? You know, if we want our kids to be doing really well, and thriving is a great way to describe it, if we want them to thrive, what are the things that they need? And the first thing they need is a sense of belonging. They need to feel like they're in a community, whether it's their family, extended family, but they need to have a sense of belonging. And because I work with a lot of teenagers who are really struggling, I get to see the other side of it. And these kids have no one. They don't feel a sense of belonging. They also need to feel safe. And safe is an interesting one, because yes, we want all of our children to feel physically safe. And in Australia, most children do. We don't feel like we're going to have bombs drop on our heads. We don't have guns in Australia. Most children feel quite safe. But I am also interested in this idea of safe, where I want our children to feel safe to make mistakes and not get shamed for it. To actually know that making mistakes, mucking up, is how you learn. And as a child, you're supposed to learn, and it's a great way to do it. What I worry about is when children make a mistake and get shamed for it. So I worked with a man who was in his 60s, and he told me that when he was a young boy, he went water skiing with his father and some friends, and he said, and he fell off, and his father made fun of him and shamed him in front of everybody else. And he told me from that day until now, and he's in his 60s, he will never try anything new because he's so in front of other people, because he's so afraid of failing and feeling that way again. Does not feel safe. They also need to be seen. They need to be seen. Children need to be seen for who they are. There's a beautiful film that came out of America called The Mask We Live In. Has anybody seen it? And it's high school students in America describing how every day before they go to school, they put on a mask to be who they think they should be so that they can have a sense of belonging, so they can feel safe, all of those things. But they're not being themselves. And at the same time, they're talking about their depression, their anxiety, their mental health issues, all of that. So for me, a huge thing is children being seen. And they're all different. Every one of our children is different. They need to be present. So they actually need to be where we, you know, where they're at now, rather than thinking and worrying about other things. And they also need to be resilient. And what I mean by resilient is they need to be able to fail, get up, and keep going. And we have a big problem in Australia with something called helicopter parenting. Do you have that here in America? Yes. So they're so looked after and they're so protected, and every kid has to win a prize. Even if you come last in the running race, you have to get a prize. When you have a party and you play pass the parcel and you unwrap it, every kid has to win something every time. And the kids have no resilience. And then when they become teenagers or later and they're actually out on their own, they really struggle when things don't go exactly as they planned and mum or dad's not there to pick them up. And so I also think about, you know, what would it be like to be a teenager today? And this first photo, and I really find this photo very interesting. Boy on a skateboard. But, you know, he's going to go. Like, he is going to go. That's the first thing. The second thing is he's not wearing any safety gear, no helmet, no pads. You'd have to be a bit worried about the outcome. And the other thing is he's totally on his own. There's nobody else there. And I think that's the way it is for a lot of teenage boys today. They're going to go. They don't think about the consequences. There's no safety. You worry about the outcome and they're on their own. And when I think about girls, this is a 15-year-old girl. You know, why would that photo worry us? She's beautiful. She's gorgeous. And yet, she's about to go out on a Friday night, on a Saturday night. Do we know where she's going? Do we know who's going to be there? Do we feel that it's going to be safe? And I think that's the way it is for a lot of girls in Australia as well. Beautiful, gorgeous, youthful, and yet they're going out into a world that's often not safe for them. I also believe that for teenagers to thrive, mentors are critical. For them to have someone other than their parents who they can talk to. Someone who can give them advice. Someone who can tell them when they're being stupid. But not their parents. And the final thing is, I strongly believe that teenagers, children need to have the stages of their lives marked and acknowledged. And that I divide it up into there are sort of young kids, 12 and under, let's say. There's the transition years between 12 and 16, 17. And then there's young adulthood. And that each of these stages is significantly different and how we parent, how we teach them, how we interact with them also has to be different. And that throughout history, these stages would have been marked. And we don't do that anymore. And the best way to keep a teenager acting as a child is to treat them as a child. And we really need to look at this. I'm very interested in this idea of what I call child to adult behavior. So a child behavior is what you would typically see in a 6 to 8 year old. And adult behavior is hopefully how all of us act now, hopefully. So the first thing about child behavior is a child thinks they're the center of the universe. You know, it's all about me. Look at me, look at me. Look at me when I'm in the park. Look at me when I'm eating my dinner. Look at me when I'm on the toilet. You know, just look at me, tell me how wonderful I am. And if I'm not getting acknowledgement by behaving well, I'll behave badly. But I need to be the center of attention. That's a child, and that's fine for a child. Hopefully, an adult actually recognizes that we're part of the universe. So I'm part of something much bigger, much greater than me. I may well be connected to it, but I'm not the center of it. And there's a big difference there. A child takes no responsibility for their action. It's always somebody else's fault. Anybody's children like that? You notice that? Something goes wrong, something happens, they break something, they don't do something. The teacher at school gave me the wrong homework. The teacher at school didn't mark my test properly. We lost the basketball game because the referee was no, you know, all of those sorts of things. No responsibility. Healthy adult behavior, we're actually accountable. We're responsible. If something doesn't work out, we absolutely need to deal with it. And the next one is that a child wants a mother or a father, which is beautiful for a 6 to 8 year old. And typically, a boy wants a mother who'll do everything for him, pick up his clothes, do his cooking, you know, kiss him when he falls over and scratches his knee. And often, if you think about the relationship between a 6-year-old boy and his mother, it can be almost abusive. And if he doesn't get what he wants, he can have a temper tantrum and, you know, punch and kick and swear, "I hate you, you're the worst mummy in the world," and all that sort of stuff. And if a 6-year-old does that, okay, that's okay. Maybe it's okay. A lot of girls want a hero father. In healthy adult behavior, we actually want relationship. And it's, you know, we're both in this together. And it's about creation and sharing and learning and growing. And for me, I believe a huge thing is to support this shift in our children from child behavior to adult behavior. And I wrote a model specifically for boys where we talk about boy behavioral psychology. A boy thinks he's the center of the universe, needs constant acknowledgement. Other males are competition. He wants as much power as he can, thinks he's going to live forever. He's ruled by his emotions. If he doesn't get what he wants, he loses his temper, and he wants a mother. Now, have any of the women in this room ever met a man who still thinks he's the center of the universe, needs constant acknowledgement, wants power, thinks he's going to live forever, can't handle his emotions, and he's looking for a mother? Anyone? So you can see we actually have a situation. And I have to say, I believe we live in a world that's ruled by boys. And that's a problem. It's a huge problem. Ruled by boys instead of ruled by healthy men and women together. And that's what we're creating. So, for those of us with, and I'm actually really glad that we've got lots of parents here with young children, because one of the things that I say is that you can't start parenting a teenager once they become a teenager. You actually have to start as early as possible. And we also need to know that how we parent teenagers, as I said before, is going to be different from how we parent children. So for fathers, and I'm a father, so when I talk about this, I'm also talking to myself. We need to realize that, you know, when our children are young, we have to set appropriate boundaries. We teach them, we tell them what to do, you know, we show them things. But once they become teenagers, a really, really critical thing is that we stop telling them how to live their lives. Our teenagers don't want to be told how they should be living their lives by us as fathers. They don't want those authority figures. What they do want, they want to hear our stories. They want to be able to ask us questions. And one of the things I say to fathers is if you want to have a good relationship with your children or anyone, with your partner or with anyone, one of the most important things to do is to spend one-on-one time with that person, turn off your mobile phone and just be with them.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Dr. Arne Rubenstein spoke at Seattle University's Piggott Hall on April 19th. The event was hosted by the Vashon Island-based organization, Journeyman. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.